You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 19th of July 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
The UK unlocks at last, or does it? Germany cleans up after terrible floods, and why is Kim Jong-un so scared of BTS? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Latika Burke and John Everard will discuss all the day's big stories. Plus, we'll consider our favourite white elephants and we'll hear about the role of the quilt as America's eternal comfort blanket. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by John Everard, former British diplomat, and by Latika Burke, journalist with the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Hello to you both. We're going to talk shortly about Freedom Day, which is today. And just first of all, Latika, I'll start with you. I wanted to ask if, have either of you noticed anything transcendentally different about Britain as you made your way here today?
Definitely. I saw a lot fewer masks on everybody. Came by public transport. There were still quite a few masks on people, I must say. And I did find myself slipping my mask on as I went into the grocery store today, even though you don't need to do that anymore. But I think the biggest change for me has been my Instagram, because I follow some people who are younger than me who actually went to Heaven Nightclub last night and posted incredible scenes, which obviously we've not seen for some time, of 20-somethings all hot and heavy in a nightclub. And I watched it with a little bit of envy, but gosh, just a little bit of worry as well.
Well, as regular listeners will be aware, that would not be high on my list of ideas of a good time, even when there isn't a pandemic on. John, I have noticed on my way here today that quite a few shops have made haste with the removal of Perspex screens, which I'm not sure is going to be necessarily welcomed by the people who work in them. But I have to say, on my tube journey in, still almost nobody on the tube, which on the central line in the middle of a weekday is remarkable. And most people on the tube, few though they were still masked up. Have you noticed anything different on your way here?
I noticed, not so much on my way here, but shopping this morning, very few of the staff were wearing masks. My local bike shop, they'd all taken their masks off. I agree with you about the Perspex screens. I mean, they are reasonably unobtrusive and do provide quite a level of protection. I think taking them down might be a little bit premature. Yes, TfL is saying 85% of passengers are wearing masks on the tube at the moment. So that chimes with your observation. That seems to be sticking. You do get oddities. If you go to Farringdon Station, for example, if you take the tube, of course, you're required to wear a mask because it's TfL. You cross the platform onto Thames Link and you're not. Chaos reigns.
Well, let's go into this in a bit greater detail, because today, July 19th, is Freedom Day. Woo and indeed who. This date has been trailed some while in advance by an arguably over-optimistic government as the day upon which the nation would bound forward from the shackles placed upon it by COVID-19 and we would once again resume our pre-pandemic lives. Instead, as if in illustration of the dangers of tempting fate, we have a health secretary who has COVID-19 and a prime minister undertaking isolation as a consequence, though not before a screeching U-turn from an attempt to award himself an exemption. Latika, the prime minister has spoken within the last hour. He has lent again on the if not now, when motif, which I think we discussed last time you were in here. You can see the logic behind it. It is summer and so forth. More and more people are getting vaccinated and so forth. And yet 47,000 odd new cases yesterday, easily on target to break the record set in January.
Yes, and I think some really interesting snippets came out today from Sir Patrick Vallance, the chief scientist, who basically said that, look, infections, hospitalisations and deaths are all going to skyrocket. Sorry, the infections are going to skyrocket. Deaths and hospitalisations will probably continue their flatter trend along. Now, he did say that he thinks that they'll get to more than 1,000 hospital admissions per day, more than 100 deaths per day. That's a significant uptick in what we've seen. But I think the most crucial thing he said was that they are hoping that this peak tails off in time by September, when children go back to school. Now, if that is what's borne out, this policy will be a winner. If it's not, we're in uncharted territory and Britain will have let off a race of virus versus vaccine and potentially lost it.
John, what did you make of yesterday's communications masterclass on the government's behalf? This was the thing where obviously Sajid Javid announced he had COVID-19, which meant obviously that he had been in contact with Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. It was floated that they didn't have to isolate because they had signed up to some pilot scheme of which not one single citizen of these Sceptred Isles had previously heard. And then in the face of really quite heartwarmingly bipartisan mockery from right across the spectrum, they backed down within 2 hours.
Yes, it was all a bit of a circus, wasn't it? You wonder what Boris Johnson was thinking. And did nobody come up to him and sort of tap on the shoulder, say, Prime Minister, so claiming you got a special exemption that not heard before? That's really not a good idea. You do get the sense that he does believe that he doesn't quite have to follow the same rules as everybody else, which, of course, doesn't go down well with either in Parliament or
does. He does have the evidence of his entire life and career to date to fall back on that front.
Well, that's right. He's consistent in that. I mean, we can give him that. But the whole thing was a farce. And the timing, of course, could not have been worse. I mean, on the eve of Freedom Day, to go and pull a stunt like that. I mean, please.
Latika, there is now some suggestion that there will be vaccine passports of some sort or another required for big events from September, which does beg the question of why that nightclub reopening couldn't have waited until then. Is that going to be an easy sell for the government?
Well, this is really interesting. The British government has channeled its inner Emmanuel Macron today in coming out and saying, look, by the time we have offered every 18-year-old and above a double jab, which will be September, we are then going to introduce vaccine passports at the nightclubs. Now, you can see where this heads. It will begin with nightclubs. We'll probably get it for theatres, mass events, and I dare say the pubs and certainly restaurants. Will it work? I don't know if it won't. Because I think also going back to what the Prime Minister did yesterday, that was also an act of frustration. You have a Prime Minister who has nearly died from coronavirus. He's been double jabbed. He's probably not got coronavirus. In fact, he has the tooling and the testing now to tell when he doesn't. And you can see a whole swathe of the population is also feeling like that. And so this pingdemic we're getting, I think, is partly this frustration. So I think actually if the government does come out and say, OK, we have given everybody the best chance to protect not just themselves but each other, some aren't playing ball. Given the vaccine take-up in this country, I think you're going to have a heck of a lot more people saying, well, I did my bit. It's now time for those people holding out to do theirs.
John, there is, I mean, I think that's true, what Latika said, that there's an amount of impatience on the part of some governments. We certainly saw that from President Macron last Monday, whose basic pitch to the French people was either get jabbed or basically you're not leaving your house ever again. And I think upwards of 3 million people signed up for their vaccinations in fairly short order afterwards. But just to go back to where we came in on this finally, and I know, you know, as governments are entitled to point out about this and about other things, hindsight is always much clearer than foresight. Was setting a date basically a good idea or not?
It was a dangerous idea. Remember, though, that when the government set the date, it said that they'll be guided by not by dates but by data, a phrase that seems to have slipped out of the government lexicon recently. And the data, of course, would have suggested quite strongly a postponement from July the 19th. But having postponed already by a month and with lots of the signs of sharpening knives amongst the Tory backbenchers, I think the Prime Minister decided he simply could not politically delay any longer, whatever advice he was getting from his scientists. As Latika says, I mean, we will have to wait and see whether this policy does actually deliver the results that the Prime Minister says. If it does, I mean, he'll come out of this smelling of roses. If not, it's going to be a very, very sticky winter for a very battered Prime Minister.
And I'll add, I think the consequences there will be huge for the rest of the world. Countries like mine in Australia are watching very eagerly and very closely with a lot of trepidation what the UK does, because this is a country with one of the highest vaccination rates, huge soaring infections, opening up when infections are going up. if this is a disaster, it will mean those countries that have chosen to eliminate or suppress or cut themselves off from the rest of the world will feel vindicated in doing so for, say, another 2 to 5 years.
Okay, well, let's look now at Germany, which is currently grappling with a more recent and more sudden natural disaster. Recent floods are now known to have killed at least 188 people across Germany and Belgium and caused astonishing damage to many towns and cities. Chancellor Angela Merkel, visiting affected locations in Germany's west, described the devastation as surreal. She also pointedly suggested that the world needed to do more and do it sooner to address climate change. Latika, it struck me that where we come from, i.e. Australia, this sort of thing, i.e. touring a recently devastated area which has fallen victim to fire or flood or storm, is something that comes up if you stick around in charge long enough as Prime Minister. It's probably not something a German Chancellor necessarily thinks they're going to have to deal with. What did you make of how she approached it?
You know, I saw a lot of parallels with this, with what happened in early 2020 in Australia when bushfires were ravaging the East Coast. And the Prime Minister there was heavily criticised for delaying his response. He was on holiday in Hawaii at the time. He chose not to come back when he was first asked. And then when he did, was criticised for this kind of insensitive tone. And once you delay a response to a disaster, I don't think you quite ever recover. And then what happens is the public associate that disaster with your personal management of it, even if that's unfair, even if this was the direct result of climate change, or even if this was just a freak accident of nature. Rightly or wrongly, they are always going to tar you with that response. And so I think the German government has, not so badly as what Scott Morrison, the Prime Minister in Australia, did, but I do think they will risk wearing the consequences of this long after Merkel has left the scene.
John, what is the importance, do you think, of a national or even regional leader turning up at a moment like this? Obviously, there's a limit to what they can practically do in the instant.
I think in the German context, it's very important. This isn't Australia. I mean, the German political culture is quite different. German leaders tend to be much more aloof, so that gestures like this stand out. Gestures like this by any German chancellor will stand out, by Angela Merkel, who is not naturally, how should we put this, not naturally touchy-feely, and was clearly making a real effort to give the human touch to her response, will be remembered especially. I think it will count for a lot. Also, of course, being well organised, as Angela Merkel always has been, she came bearing gifts, €300 million of instant relief and promise of a proper plan next week, which, Germany being Germany, will actually be delivered.
And Latika, again, this is something that Australians have had to get used to, not just in recent years, but over the centuries. I can recall seeing stories more than once of farmers in Queensland and New South Wales being entitled to claim drought relief and flood relief at exactly the same time, having had one follow on top of another. Given especially what Merkel has said about climate and what we are starting to understand about climate, is this something Europe is going to have to learn to get used to?
Obviously, in Australia, we have a big problem with, I guess it's climate change denialism. There's a reluctance to accept that climate change is something that we are causing, that we can mitigate and therefore should address. But one of the interesting things that has happened as a result of that is that the same politicians who deny climate change or don't want to do anything then turn the conversation very quickly to weather management, to disaster resilience, to how to equip those populations to deal better when the next bushfire comes, when the next flooding comes, or coastal erosion. Now, I think that that's actually probably a bit ahead of where the rest of the world, particularly those who've not really borne the brunt of extreme weather events like Australia has. We're seeing it right now also in Northern America. And don't forget that very, very weird hot summer we had a couple of years ago here, where all sorts of things were happening across the continent, where it was just so, so hot. So yes, I do think this is actually part of that conversation. We've been very distracted this year in net zero, COP26, how the world is going to come around that agreement. There's a lot you can do on the local level here for preparing those populations for resilience against climate change.
But John, thinking in the longer term and hopefully in terms of solutions, if we're being blunt about it, is an event like this or an acceleration of events like this, is that going to be what actually gets the governments of rich countries to take climate change more seriously, if this is not some abstract thought about a thing which is largely going to affect people all the way over there, but, oh, actually, this is happening here in our traditionally mild and temperate places.
Yes, I think that's likely. Angela Merkel, I think, summed up very nicely when she said, we complained about the cost of dealing with climate change. This is the cost of not dealing with climate change. Which do you want? It's a very fair point. But it won't just be governments who will be startled into action by this. The scientists are in complete disarray. Their modelling did not predict this flooding, or rather they predicted it, but much further down the line. This was not supposed to happen yet, and it was not supposed to happen at this scale. And the modellers are now saying that you have to programme in the possibility that climate change actually produces what they call non-linear events. That is not a question of the world slowly getting warmer and in a more or less predictable way demonstrating certain extreme climate conditions. That you get shocks, you get jolts to the system, which in turn produce other jolts. People have been worrying for a long time about the melting of the Arctic ice, and I think that worry has now come to the fore. I suspect that a lot of people will be burning midnight oil, trying to work out a model that accommodates what we just witnessed, and I suspect the results of that model will be deeply uncomfortable.
Well, I hope they'll be burning something a little less polluting than that, John, all things considered. Latika, does it surprise you, though, because it surprises me about Australia, that all things considered, it's not like climate change denialism is a minority fringe opinion in Australia. And if you know, actual events and obvious impact of those events has not changed that in Australia, then what chance does Europe have?
I'm a bit more pessimistic than John. I think those in favour of addressing climate change have long been making that argument right back, you know, the last decade that I can remember in my time as a political reporter in Australia, at least, that the cost of not addressing climate change is going to be so much greater than the cost of doing it. The problem is, when you consistently go to populations and ask them, are you willing to pay for things like higher petrol? Are you willing to pay for higher gas? Are you willing to pay more to heat your home at night? But, oh, the cost of living elsewhere is rising. You see disaster, and I think there's huge disaster fatigue setting in. So I think the ability of people to isolate one particular disaster, relate it to a cause, and then understand that paying for this will help detract from that. I think these things are going to be lost in the climate that we're in. So I don't want to be a downer, because obviously I'm very in favour, of course, of governments acting where they can. But I think the realities are, populations have shown time and time again they don't want to pay. And really interestingly, in Britain, you're starting to see this emerge. This is a country where there is cross-partisan support for net zero, but you are just starting to see a little pushback from the government backbenchers. You're just starting to see a bit more reporting, primarily in the red tops, but it's also seeping through to some of the Tory press and becoming a bit more mainstream. Just asking this question, are you willing to pay for more expensive flights for your holiday to Spain this week? Are you willing to pay for higher petrol? The answer is usually no.
Latika Burke and John Everard, thank you both for the moment. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. We will have more from our panel right after this.
Allianz is proud to partner The Monocle Daily on Monocle 24. Mental health is a major challenge facing society today. As a result of the pandemic and the added stress and isolation that have accompanied it, the number of people managing mental health concerns has grown significantly in the past year. Allianz believes that only by feeling strong and good about ourselves can we take on more in life and feel confident for what lies ahead. In an ever more complex world, our mental health is the very foundation for us to grow and feel more secure. Therefore, Allianz aims to be the peace of mind button, providing customers with resources, access, and support to help enhance their mental health. Behind you for what's ahead. Allianz, confidence in tomorrow.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests Latika Burke and John Everard. We owe the phrase white elephant, it says here, to the practice of Asian monarchs of yore giving the eponymous creatures as gifts to favoured supplicants, thus furnishing them with the mixed blessing of a prestigious yet high-maintenance behemoth they couldn't give away. Meeting this description is the railway station at Canfranc in the mountains on the Spanish-French border, a veritable cathedral which has operated little beyond a limited local service this last half century. It is to be repurposed now as a grand hotel, emphasising destination rather than embarkation. John, I for one would absolutely stay here. It is an amazing looking building. It's a preposterous folly built in the almost literal middle of nowhere and has been really neither use nor ornament for a long time. It's almost disappointing that they're going to do something that turns a profit with it. Would you stay there?
I would, but I think you and I might get quite lonely. I mean, it is in the middle of nowhere. And I have the sense that we are that what we're doing is turning one type of white elephant into, after the expense of considerable amounts of money, into another type of white elephant, a beautiful five-star hotel in the middle of the Pyrenees with no obvious attractions anywhere around it, just stuck there.
I mean, there's mountains and trees.
Yes, there's mountains and trees, but I mean, you know, there's mountain trees all over the Pyrenees. Are you really going to go and sit in the next railway station to enjoy them at five-star prices?
Latika, do you have a particular white elephant? And for the purposes of moving this item seamlessly along, does it happen to be a large hotel somewhere?
Yes, it does.
Excellent.
I was very, very intrigued to see that the North Koreans had built what is the world record for being the largest but never occupied hotel in Pyongyang, which I think is quite hilarious and very North Korean.
John, have you visited this building?
Yes, I have. I mean, you're not allowed in. The North Koreans are not surprisingly a little bit sort of reluctant to allow visits. But you can't miss it. I mean, it looms over central Pyongyang. And you have completely surreal conversations with North Korean guides where you point to it and say, "No, what's that?" And they say, "What's what?" It officially doesn't exist. And the North Korean government, of course, has been profoundly embarrassed by this for a long, long time, to the extent
They're profoundly embarrassed by that, as opposed to the not short list of other things by which they could be profoundly embarrassed.
Well, there are a few things more embarrassing than building a hotel you can't use, plonking it right in the middle of your capital city and hadn't pretended it doesn't exist. I mean, even by North Korean standards, you are hitting the extremes there.
I mean, sorry to harp on this, John, but are you aware of who they thought was going to stay there? I mean, presumably when somebody came to them with this idea, you know, that we're going to build the world's largest hotel in Pyongyang of all places, which, as Latika suggested, is not one of the world's most trafficked tourist destinations.
No.
What did they think it was going to be for?
It's not the most trafficked destinations, you're quite right, but it hasn't got that many rival hotels. So you probably would never have filled it, but you could probably have got some halfway decent occupancy rate if that is, and this was the key problem with the hotel, you'd built it straight. It's not only very tall, it's slightly wobbly to the extent that you can't put lifts in. And without lifts, the 120th floor and above become very, very tiring to reach.
Well, just the 120th floor and above, you'd have no problem sort of like vaulting up the odd, you know, 60 or 70 stories.
I'd be sprinting up there with you, Andrew.
Latika, I was trying to think of an illustrative Australian white elephant. I came up with Canberra. Is that a bit harsh?
Ooh, that's a bit below the belt.
I know. I lived there long enough to be allowed to make the jokes.
Can I submit a planned or touted but unbuilt white elephant, which I think is Boris Johnson's idea to build the Garden Bridge across the Thames, which after millions and millions of dollars of consultation has never seen the light of day.
He did have a fondness for them, though. I think, you know, we also owe him, where he had the idea there was going to be a motorway from Scotland to Northern Ireland, or a tunnel to Ireland, and the cable car, which nobody uses, I think we owe Boris Johnson for, don't we? Or
yes.
He owes us for,
yes.
More likely.
He has never seen a waterway he hasn't wanted to put a bridge over, regardless of how many people might use that bridge or whether it's even feasible.
John, is this ludicrous hotel in Pyongyang your actual favourite white elephant, present or past?
It's up there in the shortlist. My actual top favourite white elephant is Prora, Hitler's great monstrosity on the Isle of Rügen in the Baltic. 10,000 rooms to accommodate 20,000 glistening Aryans who would do Kraft durch Freude, strength through joy exercises there on the beautiful Baltic beach, sort of flexing their muscles and doing dirty Nazi things. Built and then abandoned in 1939 because the Second World War, you probably recall, intervened, and tourism on the Baltic became a secondary consideration, and just sat there for years and years and years. It's finally been de-white elephantized. Is that a word? But from 2019, part of it has become a youth hostel, and part of it has become a Farsa hotel. They're trying to work out still what to do with the middle bit. 10,000 rooms is an awful lot of space to occupy.
I do kind of admire it when people realize they've been stuck with a thing and then just try to style it out. It came up in a different context a few weeks ago on this program, but the Palace of the Republic in Romania, sort of ghastly folly built by the Ceausescus, which I think in terms of footprint is the world's second biggest building after the Pentagon, and they have now turned it into the Houses of Parliament and pretty much the entire seat of government. But it's just horrible, and apparently it was just too expensive and too difficult to get rid of it.
I must say, this is not quite a white elephant, but when I saw the Gaudi Cathedral in Barcelona, I did have this kind of feeling, is this thing ever going to be finished? And what the hell is it?
Well, I'm just...
I know that's a controversial opinion.
It is a controversial one, and I'm warning you now from past experience that the people of Catalonia are quite quick on the angry email. Hi to all our listeners in Catalonia, if you're listening. We should move along, finally, to John's former bailiwick of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, where Kim Jong-un, the supreme leader thereof, has inveighed against cultural incursion from the South. Specifically, he is vexed by the spread of slang terms which appear to have their origins in South Korean pop music. According to North Korean newspaper Rodong Sinmun, whose editorial line rarely deviates over much from official thinking, and I quote, "The ideological and cultural penetration under the colourful coloured signboard of the bourgeoisie is even more dangerous than enemies who are taking guns." May have lost something in the translation. Penalties for transgression will include deportation to a prison camp, possibly death. John, how much South Korean pop culture does get into North Korea? And I think more to the point, all jokes aside, why are North Koreans willing to run the clearly not inconsiderable risks of consuming it?
Answer the first question, a great deal. All my North Korean friends knew a lot about South Korean pop culture. They tended to be, sort of rather towards my age rather than the younger generation. So it tended not to be K-pop. I was spared that, at least. But they knew all about South Korean soap operas. They knew the plot. They knew the characters. And they were sitting in closed groups watching this. Why did they do it? I mean, what else do you do? North Korea has failed in all kinds of ways. Okay, we talked about hotel building, a salient point, but it's also failed culturally. Now, if you are a North Korean sitting on a winter evening in Pyongyang, what is there to entertain you? Don't even think about North Korean television. There's a circus and there's a gym, and that's about it. If you can somehow lay hands on a USB stick containing South Korean soap operas, invite your most trusted friends around, lock the doors, black off the windows and watch it. I mean, hey, what an evening. You can see why what the attraction is.
Latika, it's not just North Korea, though. It is an extreme example of this, as it is of most things. But it's a commonplace of tyrannies. They're genuinely frightened of popular culture.
Of course. And why wouldn't they be? They have a community they've brainwashed, and suddenly this community gets to see, hang on, people like that live that way, and they're just across the border, and they look a bit like me, and we speak a similar language. I mean, they have everything to fear from their communities, seeing how the rest of the world lives. And also, dare I say, freedom of expression. I mean, this is really tied up, and a lot of parallels here with China. When you see people elsewhere beginning to express themselves in cultural ways that are not allowed in your own community, you can understand why this is a tide that the North Koreans feel they might not be able to push back on eventually one day. This will overwhelm and engulf them.
It's also a question of legitimacy. There's a central question in North Korea to which the regime never has an answer. Why should the peninsula remain divided? Why should you guys, under Kim, run the northern half, whereas the southern half is clearly massively more successful economically and also produces good films and, okay, produces K-pop too, but you can't have everything. this question terrifies the central leadership. They're trying to answer it by simply suppressing it. Stopping people ask that question, saying, no, we are North Koreans. The Pyongyang dialect is pure. You must speak the Pyongyang dialect only. I doubt very much that this new rule, however hard they try to enforce it, will gain traction. I think they're on a hiding to nothing. They alienate young North Koreans. They alienate people in the very class that they most desperately need to keep on side. And I suspect that this might be one of the first cracks in the facade of North Korean political unity.
I mean, John, you're quite right to point out the extraordinary risks people are willing to run to just avoid being bored. The only regime on earth the last few decades which has been close to North Korea was the Taliban's Afghanistan in the 90s. And I remember when I visited there in about 1998, and this is at a time when, I mean, pretty much everything was illegal except beard growing, which doesn't really pass an evening that quickly. But treasured possession were any VHS VCR that anybody had saved from the Taliban's rampages, and rather depressingly bootleg copies of Rambo films, which were incredibly popular among young Afghans, though you would have thought, really, guys, you only need to step outside and you can have it for real. Is there, all that said, then, a case for South Korea putting those big loudspeakers back up and just letting them have it, just blasting BTS across the DMZ all day, every day?
I think the loudspeakers probably are a bit of a white elephant, to come back to one of my previous stories. But I think there's a strong case for the South Koreans just buying up the copyright to lots and lots of good South Korean soap operas, producing enormous numbers of USB sticks and just handing them out to any North Korea who wants them. No, flood the place. Let them watch all this stuff. Let them make their own minds up.
And Andrew, what a win for soft power that would be. What a wonderful, gentle sword that would be to sway through the North Korean tyranny.
Latika Burke and John Everard, thank you both for joining us on The Daily. Finally, on today's show, we cross the Atlantic. The premise that division is a hallmark of life in the United States is not a new one, but the fine people at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston believe that there is one object which has threaded itself, and right there you can see where we're going, this through national life in the US since the birth of the Republic, and the one that can bridge divides now. It is the quilt. The museum's new book, Fabric of a Nation, American Quilt Stories, traces the history of this textile craft in the US. Monocle's Thomas Lewis spoke to one of its authors and the curator of textiles at Boston's MFA, Jennifer Swope, on how the story of the quilt became an American story as well.
The Museum of Fine Arts has been in existence for 150 years. For the last 120 or so, it's collected some amazing examples of American quilts and bed covers, because there are so many people who make quilts today, and quilts really touch so many people's lives, that we thought this is a real opportunity to show essentially 300 years, five centuries of American bed covers and quilts. We started to realize, like, wow, we could really tell a pretty broad story. Obviously, no one museum collection can capture, like, the entire history of the Americas, or even North America, or even the United States. Looking back at the early examples, we know a lot about the complicated history of how cotton was cultivated, and it was a global industry, and the enslaved labor that it depended on. The history of textiles is a fraught human history. We are so lucky to have wonderful examples from the 20th century, and that started a really interesting conversation with contemporary artists. They were looking back at history and using textiles, or even just using the quilt, sort of the idiom of quilt design, to look back at the history of the nation and introduce more complicated narratives. in the 1970s when quilts, certain quilts like Amish quilts, were put in art museums and sort of held up as emblems of prescient abstraction. And how did these farm women know that the two-dimensional picture plane was going to become so important? And which is so great for quilts because it brought a whole new generation of people into making them and into celebrating them. But it is very interesting that quilts touch so many people's lives, yet the meaning to people is very personal. So in telling these stories about quilts and the story of how it parallels the history of the United States and the Americas.
Seven feet.
We can also just go deeper. We have a really moving quilt by Carolyn Mutzlumi, who is an artist and historian, on the song Strange Fruit. It's often called America's first protest song.
Blood on the leaves.
And that quilt, in the context of understanding the legacy of the Civil War, so we can introduce the Civil War with three quilts. One is from the antebellum period, one is from the Civil War that was made in 1864, and the other looks back, made by an older woman looking back on her life before her father was a veteran of the war and how their lives changed. So we can go into, well, what's the legacy of the Civil War? So we have these quilts that are, you know, made between the 1980s to today that respond to Jim Crow laws and the Civil Rights Movement.
I told everybody over the radio, make up the mind and get together, break up this old Jim Crow.
And then all the way to today, to the murder of George Floyd, one artist, Michael Thorpe, made a piece that he woke up and made it the day after the murder of George Floyd.
Take your knee off our necks!
Take your knee off our necks!
So some of the stories, actually, the Carolyn Mutzlumi, who is the historian and artist from Ohio who made Strange Fruit, she describes quilts as soft landings for tough conversations. So we can bring people into these stories with these beautiful works of art. We wanted to show African-American, Asian-American, Native American, and Latinx works of art together. We didn't want to have a separate exhibition on African-American quilts, let's say, because even though our collection, we could do that with our collection, we wanted to pull them into a broader chronological narrative that in the exhibition we're disrupting with contemporary works of art as people go through. And we're hoping to sort of upend people's expectations that, you know, this is not the quilt show that I would have thought, in that there will be like a very diverse range of work. There is this elemental quality, particularly to textiles, because, you know, we all touch textiles every single day, and there's an immediacy to the medium that we're hoping will bring people into the message. And unpacking sort of how that happened and how quilts became so associated with the American experience, even though quilts are made all over the world throughout human history, has really been one of the fun aspects of investigating this collection and publishing the book, and will be a big part of the exhibition.
That was Jennifer Swope from Boston's Museum of Fine Arts in a report by Monocle's Thomas Lewis. And that brings us to the end of today's edition of the Monocle Daily. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu, with editing assistance from Jack Dewars. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.